Good day, and welcome to episode 11 of The Coriolis Effect. Don't let the pretty face fool you. I'm a beast. My name's Dave.
And I'm Matthew. And today we've got an episode that we're squeezing out before, first of all, Dave, and then I go on holiday.
Squeezing out sounds really disgusting.
So we wanted to get this one out, and not just before we go on holiday, but also before the Forbidden Lands Kickstarter finishes. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, because, as usual, we'd like to tell you what's going on. And first of all, we are going to talk about, among other things, the Forbidden Lands Kickstarter in the world of gaming. Then you've got a really interesting little essay you've written on the Nazarene sacrifice, which I'm very keen to hear about, Dave. And then we've got another Players in the Hammam with Tony joining us again, talking about all sorts of things, quite a wide-ranging discussion, but starting off with your Tango Tango 82 game, Dave.
Yeah, a little reprise on a player perspective on how that went, and thoughts for the future, maybe.
Yeah, for the future indeed. And then I've got a new talent of the episode that our other player, Andy, was really keen for me to invent, so I've done that. He really likes it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing that.
And you've got a bit of a catch-up. Sorry?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing all about that talent of the week.
And then you've got an upset, an update, I should say, or perhaps it was an upset, who can tell, on the crew of the Spectral Corsair.
We do.
And we're finishing off this episode with some very special news. So do stay listening right to the end.
Right, but, well, shall we start off with Forbidden Lands in the world of gaming?
Yeah, so as we're recording, there are still 3 days to go for the Forbidden Lands Kickstarter. I imagine and I hope that all our listeners have already kicked in. But if you haven't, this episode should be hitting the internet with at least 24 hours to go. So get on the internet, get to Kickstarter and bid whatever you can for Forbidden Lands.
Well, there's no pressure on you now, though, is there, Matt? Because you're editing this one, so that gives you 36 hours to get it done and get it out there.
And I'll do that. I'll do that. I've got the incentive to do that.
Excellent.
And it's been a really successful campaign for Free Elegan. There's just one more stretch goal to get, which I think would be quite a fun one. It's the legend and character generator, one aspect of which I believe will start give you an opportunity to randomise your history. And as an old Traveller fan, I quite like the idea of seeing what my character might have got up to in the past.
I like that. That's one of the things I did really like about Traveller, is it giving you, as part of your character generation, such a sort of rich background that you receive your character at the end of that. And I really like that, because sometimes making up your whole background yourself, which is great, but actually sometimes it's nice to take control of the character part of the way through their life.
Yeah. I mean, I like both ways of doing it. Sometimes I don't want, the dice to dictate the background of my character. I've got a very firm idea in my head of what my character might have done. Sometimes I want to discover what my character did in the past through play round the table now. I like to have a really thin sketch of a character to begin with and explore who that person is as we go through play. But sometimes I just love rolling up a Traveller character and then dealing in play with whatever that's left me.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last time I was playing, I had a crippled Vargir, Wolfman, and he was great. I really loved playing him, even though he was no good in a fight.
I think sometimes there's a lot of fun in role-playing around the things that you don't like very much about your character, about his background. There are things in everyone's life you don't like very much. It hasn't all worked out exactly how you wanted it to. And sometimes just being given that challenge is a really good part of role-playing, rather than just deciding exactly what those challenges are because you like the idea of those challenges. So, yeah.
You are so right. That's why you're the best player, Dave. But one of the stretch goals that we have already hit is something that I'm very excited about and very proud of, because it was my idea.
That was my idea, that is.
It was indeed.
That wasn't my idea.
And it's it's the open game license that Fela Gann have done, which will sort of, we wait to see exactly what it will entail, but it offers out into the community the what's becoming called the Year Zero engine. I wonder who said that first. the Year Zero engine out for people to publish content for apparently all the games that Fela Gann release, and maybe, you know, interestingly, some games that might be based on that engine but with entirely new content, like, I'm thinking, Tango Tango 82.
Absolutely, yeah. This open game license is absolutely perfect for me because it's exactly the kind of thing I want to be doing. But also, I think it works really well for both of us because we can then more easily put out all the stuff that we're talking about, maybe work it up in a bit more detail, and stick it out there for the rest of the community to play with, in a way that perhaps we wouldn't have been able to, you know, in a more professional way, rather than just doing it in an amateur way that we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about what that might open up.
Absolutely.
In another aspect of gaming news, I think the challenge to Forbidden Lands sweeping the floor with Kickstarter has been that just a few days after the Kickstarter opened, another Kickstarter opened for, if you like, a far bigger, more popular game, and that's Numenera, the second edition of Numenera,
yes.
Where they appear to have quickly looked at what Forbidden Lands was doing and thought, we need to do that too. So the second edition of Numenera, which I don't know, Dave, whether you've ever seen it or played it, but it's kind of set in the far, far future in the last days of Earth. Nine whole versions of humanity have risen to prominence and been destroyed by various disasters. So
now I'm familiar,
looking millennia away.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I've never actually played it myself.
Yeah, so it was, you know, it's quite an exciting game of exploration and discovering the artifacts, strange artifacts that previous civilizations have left. But, well, I had a problem with it at the time. It was one of the first Kickstarters I considered investing in, and in the end I didn't. Partly because when I got down to it, it's a D20 engine, and I'm not a big fan of that. But this time round, they've got a sort of a second game, which is less about exploration and more about building your stronghold, which I thought they must have got that idea off Fela Gann and quickly added that in.
Perhaps. It's difficult to tell, isn't it?
No, obviously they didn't. The Kickstarter started so close, I'm pretty sure they had that idea beforehand.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wish them all the luck in the world, but I'm hoping they're not taking any of Fela Gann's Kickstarter money away from them. If you're going to go for both, by all means go for both, but make sure you support Forbidden Lands first.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you say about D20 games, because I've been playing a bit of Dungeons & Dragons down the pub again for the first time in about 25 or 30 years. And I'm really enjoying it. But again, I'm not entirely convinced that I really enjoy the D20 mechanic in the way that I like the Year Zero engine. But also,
yeah,
I've just started with our group, with, you know, you, Tony, and Andy when he turns up for a game, Simba Room, which is another fantasy setting with a D20 dice mechanic with a lot of very similar feel to Dungeons and Dragons, but a bit simpler and a bit less rules heavy. And we played our first game of that yesterday. We recorded it. If it's good enough, we might stick it out as an actual play just to see if people are interested. But
it is Swedish, after all, even if it's not a Year Zero engine game.
Yeah, it's a Järnring.
So I think we can cover it.
It's a Järnringen game, and it's excellent. I love it, and we've talked about it before on this podcast. But I don't want your sort of dislike of the D20 system to adversely impact your enjoyment of that particular campaign. Having just started it, it's something that it gives a slightly different flavour to it. It doesn't stop me enjoying D&D when I play it, but I do prefer the handful of dice mechanic that you get in Coriolis and Mutant Year Zero. Or other games, Legend of the Five Rings.
I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons a bit more recently, and again, like you, after a break of about 25 years. And, I think you know, for me, it's a totally irrational prejudice I have against D20. Yes, it's a linear system, but I quite enjoy percentile games, and they're just as linear.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it doesn't quite have the nuancing of a percentile game. There's, you know, everything happens in units of, if you like, 5% with a D20, but something about it, you know, sometimes when you fail a roll in a D20 game like Simba Room, I sense a real sense of disappointment that I don't sense when I've thrown a whole bunch of dice. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, we discussed earlier on when Coriolis first came out and people were experiencing it, a lot of people had a problem with the dice pool system because they were throwing a lot of dice and not getting many successes.
No.
That doesn't bother me at all. But when I roll in Simba Room, rolling high is a miss rather than rolling low. But, you know, when I roll above the target number and therefore miss my hit or whatever, then I'm gutted on the D20 in a way that I'm not in most other games.
I
think it's just something I have to get over with.
Yeah, I do wonder whether, to be a bit frivolous here, you know, we roll so badly 90% of the time in Coriolis, we expect to fail anyway. So actually, rolling a bad set of dice doesn't make any difference. But the other point, I think it is such a, as we talked about ages ago, it's such a binary on or off thing with a D20. And my dice rolling in the D&D game with the D20s that I had from 30 years ago was so bad, I went out and bought myself about 6 different new D20s, a couple of really nice metal heavy ones, and they're just as shit as the other ones were anyway. So it does have
It doesn't help.
It doesn't help. No, I agree. But
I just thought there's a bit of gaming news actually, which we didn't discuss, but I just thought I'd add that in since you mentioned it. You know, there's dice pool in L5R.
Mm.
There are some new beta rules for the new edition of L5R out. We'll comment on that in a future episode, so I don't think either of us or any of us have had a chance to read it yet, but we will come back to that one.
Now, I think the one thing I would say was I'm really pleased that Fantasy Flight, isn't it, doing it? I've actually chosen to continue the L5R game going forward. I hope they haven't badly damaged it or changed it too much, because the game as it stands, the fourth edition, is absolutely brilliant, I think. But the very fact that it isn't just dying and disappearing into the mists of history is a really good thing, I think. So I'm very pleased.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. I've had a quick glance through the rules. There's a lot of things I like about it. They've got a form of roll and keep, not quite the same form of roll and keep that we're used to from the fourth edition. But we'll talk about that some more maybe in the next episode.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Let's get into things Coriolis now, though, shall we?
Yep, let's do that. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about the Nazarene sacrifice, largely because Yaphet was tinkering with that. And I've had, I've had a few more thoughts about it. So did you want to hear those now, Matthew?
Yeah, I'd love to. Tell me.
Let's do that. Yaphet was sure. This bullet had his name on it. It was bang on the bullseye. He was about to die. He closed his eyes for the last time, his life flashing through his mind. It was a troubled picture, and it was short. Icons, damn it, it was so unfinished. But the pain didn't come. Yaphet heard the whish of a bullet pass by his ear, heard the zing of a ricochet off the ornate brass lamp hanging from the wall behind him, heard it crash to the floor and the quiet whoomp of a fire bursting freely into life. In the fraction of a moment that followed, Yaphet felt something around him, with him, protecting him. He couldn't see it, but he felt it, felt the hand of the beast saving him for better things. He fell to the ground, his eyes tight shut, but mind and soul more open than ever before. It was all so clear now. The book his old friend, Manon, from all those years on Carmarook, had given him, now made complete sense. Yaphet had liked the tales, the proverbs, the teachings Manon had tried so hard to pass on, in whispered voices and darkened chambers. But he hadn't really got it, hadn't really understood the sacrifices made, the selfless destiny of Nazarene, the things the dancer demanded in his form of the beast, the things the beast promised to the faithful. But now he did. Lying prone on the floor of that Coriolis spice bazaar, Japhet opened his eyes on a world that was new in almost every respect. And the beast had made his point clear. Japhet understood, and knew he had to do something about it. The end of the last scenario in the Mukafar campaign saw Japhet survive a roll of 66 on the critical hit table, thanks to his dancer's talent and the intervention of the beast. I had been thinking a little bit about the Nazarene sacrifice, as Japhet had been tinkering with that theology. But now he's totally committed to it, I had to take the time to really look at what the book said, and what this might mean for the objectives and hopes of Nazarene sacrifice, and what influence this would have on Japhet. Nazarene sacrifice was a first-come faction that worshipped the dancer, but in that icon's alternate aspect of the beast. Many believe that the beast represents mankind's deepest, truest nature of inherent evil and power through strength, and the extreme idea that to achieve perfect beauty, you must be free of any morality. Absolute nihilism, reflecting the accepted perception of the First Horizon at the time of the Portal Wars, was a given. Rumours abounded that Nazarene sacrifice practiced human sacrifice, performed dark rituals, and made unholy alliances with evil spirits. If the rival factions in the Third Horizon needed any more reason to hate Nazarene sacrifice, these rumours gave them ample ammunition. This all sounds fine, I suppose, but so far so psycho. For me, it conjures images of psychotic bio-sculpting experiments and utter brutality. Something out of the Saw movies, perhaps. Chaotic evil, in its truest sense. I've played a psychopathic character before, and while the freedom this offers is fun, ultimately it makes for a pretty shallow role-playing experience. I wasn't too upset when Stonewall Jackson died at his own hand, critically failing to lay some explosives, and I certainly didn't want to go down that route with Japhet. His faith in the beast is a more complex and nuanced creature. So what might this search for perfect beauty actually mean? And what might it involve? Are we talking about Nishka in Firefly and his adherence to the teachings of Shan Yu? Live with a man 40 years, share his house, his meals, speak on every subject, then tie him up and hold him over the volcano's edge. And on that day, you'll finally meet the man. This idea works brilliantly in Firefly, but I don't see Japhet as a young Nishka, torturing people willy-nilly for some pseudo-scientific purpose, but in fact, just for the psychotic fun of it. Maybe the most extreme accusations, human sacrifices and the like, are just that, made-up stories to turn the people against the faction. But who knows what Nazarene sacrifice really got up to in hidden cloisters and behind closed doors. But Japhet doesn't subscribe to these extremes. To his mind, his objective here is really scientific, rather than pseudo-scientific. But he is obedient to the beast. So while he won't go out of his way to find harmful methods to further his studies, he won't shirk from them either when the science and the theology tell him it's necessary. But back to Nazarene sacrifice. The faction's adherents believe this nihilistic and brutal search for perfect beauty will open the doors to unfathomable power. So perhaps it's little wonder they would try to seek out this knowledge. They were one of the few factions at the time of the Portal Wars who truly understood the portals, at least as well as the Foundation or the Order of the Pariah. Perhaps there was much envy and fear in the Third Horizon about the knowledge and power of Nazarene sacrifice, based purely on political reasons. And perhaps the Portal Wars simply gave the Order of the Pariah and their fair-weather allies the pretext to destroy a faction that might rival their dominance. I love the idea of the powerful factions concocting a bogeyman myth to demonise a rival and justify military action to remove that rival. The fact that the behaviour of Nazarene sacrifice gave the Order of the Pariah plenty to work with is neither here nor there. But I'm not trying to say that the Third Horizon isn't a better and happier place without Nazarene sacrifice. But perhaps their enemies saw a golden opportunity and took it. But whatever the reason, Whether it was the righteous cleansing of a beastly organization, or a political quick step to eliminate an economic, military, and theological rival, or perhaps a mixture of the two, Nazarene's sacrifice was ruthlessly destroyed during the war. They were portrayed as the lackeys of the First Horizon, and thus were surely seen as traitors to the Third Horizon. Certainly, it doesn't seem that many in the Third Horizon mourned their passing. The Order of the Pariah led a loose coalition of other factions, including the Draconites, and perhaps most tellingly the Legion, and hunted down the devotees of the Beast. The decisive battles were fought in Odicon, where Nazarene sacrifice was finally defeated and scattered to the far reaches of space. The portals to the First Horizon were closed, sealing them off for good, and bringing victory to the Third Horizon. But the faction hasn't passed entirely into the history books. It lives on, in hiding, in valleys and woods, dark city streets, and behind the veil of respectable business and communities. It may not be strong, and it may be scattered far and wide, but the worship of the Beast survives, and one day Nazarene sacrifice will rise again and take its revenge. So what does all this mean for Japhet and his relationship with the Beast? The book says that the dancer is seen with a sweeping shawl and welcomes sacrifices of an exquisite meal, a dance, or a song. The book also tells us that the Beast is represented by a dragon-like creature with fur and 9 eyes. I've said before that Japhet's dance to the Beast is akin to the Haka, an aggressive war dance that challenges our enemies. This feels right to me, although there would be some terrible ironic black humour in an elegant or gentle dance form to worship such an icon. I also see the Beast as humanoid, with the reptilian features of a dragon, terrible claws, and an array of black eyes, large and small, not dissimilar to those of a spider. The Beast cloaks his form in an exotic animal skin kaftan and dupatta, instead of a sweeping shawl. So what does Japhet's devotion to the Beast tell him, or inspire him to do? Well, the idea of revenge against the enemies of Nazarene's sacrifice must be right up there. And surely, Japhet needs little prompting to nurse a grudge against the Order of the Pariah. They did take him as a slave. They did oppress him. They did order his death. But it's not just the Zelusians who are ripe for the Beast's vengeance. Not only are the Draconites and the Legion legitimate targets, but also the Black Lotus assassins from Alarm's Temple were tireless in their pursuit of the Nazarene sacrifice's leaders, and there's a special place in the Beast's hell for them. But Japhet is an engineer with an insatiable curiosity to see how things work. He won't go out of his way to cause needless harm in doing so, unless that's harm to the Beast's enemies, perhaps. But considerations of morality, fairness, and justice won't bear on his conscience if the ends justify the means. His time awake in portal space gave him an insight into that dimension, and now he must learn more about it. He must learn enough about the portals to find and reopen those gates to the First Horizon. Then, and only then, can the wrongs of the portal wars be put right.
Well, Dave, when you said you were going to write about Nazarene sacrifice, I thought, oh God, because I know where Japhet's going, and I've got in my head a really clear idea of what I think the Nazarene sacrifice are about. And I thought, oh God, if you do something radically different, then what am I going to do as a GM? I like my Nazarene sacrifice, I might not like yours. But actually, you've done that thing that I love about Coriolis, where there are two different sides to everything.
Yep.
So that's good. You're writing in the Coriolis style. I can fit this Nazarene sacrifice, I think, very well into our campaign. I particularly like to see Shan Yu being quoted there. as you know, we're both big Firefly fans. And this is Firefly crossed with Arabian Nights, so I was very pleased to see that.
I was partly quoting Shan Yu to say that that's not how I'm going to want Japhet to play it. But
That's okay. But you got the quote in there.
Yeah. Well, I that's a quote that's just been begging to go into one of our podcasts. So, the opportunity was just too good this time.
No, that's good to see. I guess the interesting thing And I probably won't commit to this. Well, we'll see how it goes. But I'm interested in the prequel scenario that we're hearing is going to come out hopefully before Christmas from the guys at Fria Lagan, which is the last voyage of... Oh, I can't remember the name of the ship. And that, I believe, is going to tell us a little bit more about the incident on Tauan.
Tauan, yeah.
And I wonder whether that will bring up another version of the Nazarene sacrifice.
Yeah, it's quite possible, isn't it? I think it was interesting, having spent some time to dig into the books and really just pull out all the Nazarene sacrifice content that was in there, I hadn't quite understood before how allied to the First Horizon the Nazarene sacrifice were. And actually that they were the interlopers in the Third Horizon who were then trying to support the First Horizon's agenda. And that was, that was really interesting. And again, the fact that the Order of the Pariah and the Legion ganged up together to destroy them, along with the Draconites, was also, again, another real good indication of the way we talked about it before, the, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend kind of attitude that the Order of the Pariah have.
Yeah. But well, it's interesting, because that bit, I had picked up on that First Horizon thing, and that was very much where I thought my version of the Nazarene sacrifice might go in our campaign. So I was kind of worried that you might not acknowledge that in what your vision of the sacrifice were going to be.
Yeah.
But you have, so that's cool.
no, because I think there's I think the risk that I came up with something here that was markedly different from your view of what you want your campaign's Nazarene sacrifice to actually be like wouldn't have actually mattered, because I was doing this, you know, as you know, having listened to it, you can see I'm interweaving it with Yaphet. So I'm doing it very much from Yaphet's perspective.
Point of view.
And actually, what he believes about the Nazarene sacrifice might be totally wrong, because he doesn't, just because he's now following it, doesn't mean he knows all the ins and outs of what the faction is like and what's left of it. He's just going on hearsay and what he's read in his little book. So actually, he doesn't know what it's like. So my view of it could be totally different to yours, but actually the reality for Yaphet in the campaign is very different. And that might be an interesting thing to play, actually, where he thinks it's one thing,
could,
but actually
it could
it's something
fall somewhere between the two.
Completely, yeah. I think the other thing that...
And you know, what I did like about that is, you know, the way you or Yaphet were suggesting that maybe the Nazarene sacrifice were just a scapegoat for the other factions in their building of political power bases, because we see that happen, don't we?
Yeah.
Modern day politics.
Yeah, exactly.
People get scapegoated.
Yeah, and this very much struck me as, you know, there were countless parallels in modern political and military history about you know, a country or a faction or an ethnic group being vilified by another group in order to justify them going and kicking the shit out of them. And I think that kind of fits quite well in here. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was the recognition in the book that the Nazarene sacrifice were at least as well learned about portal space algorithms and the use of portal space than anybody else in the Third Horizon. And it raised a really interesting idea, which I think is something that I would want Yaphet to push with. Partly also...
Particularly after your adventure in portal space, actually.
Well, I was just about to say, partly driven by the fact that he's now seen portal space and he's had an insight into some of that. And so he, I think, wants to search for the secrets of portal dynamics and the algorithms in order, as I say in the piece, to reopen the First Horizon portals, but not just to do that. Because there's a really interesting thing. Is it feasible, do you think, for... the people of the Third Horizon to work out the secrets of the portals so they can jump from one portal to a different portal than the one next down the line. Now, so I've taken a line from the portal misjump table to argue that yes, that is theoretically feasible. Because if you misjump, there is a chance that you'll go into the portal and you'll come out somewhere completely random. It's a small chance,
yes,
but there's a chance. And if there's a chance of it happening, surely there's a chance of us unlocking the way of doing it safely. So actually, there might be a way. And I'm thinking that, you know, this is what Yaphet is also trying to uncover. the secrets to be able to jump maybe two portals or three portals at a time rather than just the one. But
yeah,
that's clearly up for you. You know, you as the man who's running the campaign.
No, I think that could be a really interesting way that we could take the campaign, actually, because something else I've been working about for a future episode kind of touches on, you know, potentially are there system races? Do people compete?
say yeah.
Maybe the opportunity to jump two portals is something we can explore. And I don't know if you've been seeing the new version of Star Trek on Netflix, but again, there's some stuff there, I think, about something different to warp technology that allows you to go further, and the terrible darkness between the stars that you might encounter when you push that too far.
Did they even call it Darkness Between the Stars?
No, they don't, but it looked pretty blooming horrific. I don't know if you haven't seen it.
I haven't yet,
no. I don't want to spoil it for you,
no.
But there are some bodies in the third episode that look like they could have gone through portal space.
Okay, fair enough.
Awake is all I'm saying. Talked plenty with Tony about your horrific game, in horrific in a good sense, Tango Tango 82, and touching on other things like the open game license as well. So let's listen to another edition of Players in the Hammam. Originally, we've invited Tony back into the Hammam because he's the only person we could find.
Unfortunately, Andy has chosen to go and do some gaming competition this weekend.
Yeah.
His loss.
His loss, our gain. Because, Tony, actually, I'm really interested in having you here because you are one of the players that played in Dave's Tango Tango 82 scenario, which we heard about in the last episode, but I didn't play in. So I'm kind of wanting to hear a player's insight into that. And remind me, were you there back in the days of Call of Cthulhu when we were playing The Thing?
No, I wasn't. Right. I did not play the original version of The Thing scenario.
Didn't think so.
So this is my first experience of it.
Anyway, if you had been there and we can remember, then it, you know, we wouldn't have been a surprise because, you know, the impact that you have in the group is so low. But
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast, guys.
Hey, look, you're my brother. I've got to be hard to...
Remember, I know we're in the Hammam, but we're not trying to recreate that last scene out of Eastern Promises.
Remember, I'm about to discuss your thin scenario. So how positive I am about that might depend on that.
So, Dave,
delight having you here, Tony. It's fabulous. It's always a pleasure. My fabulous older brother.
Thanks.
So, Tony, be really honest now. Who's the best GM?
Oh, definitely, Matthew, you are, clearly.
I thought I'd get that one in. No, I'm for a winner here.
Just before, I'd like to point out the method of Tony returning to his home today. So, Tony, in light of that, who's the best GM?
Oh, you're the best GM then, Dave.
Well, let's not get into that argument again, because there are obviously clear winners and losers there.
The loser makes it being me, is what I can say.
Tony, tell us about Tango Tango 82 from a player's perspective.
Now, Dave, I have to be completely honest and say that it was really, really good. Thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. Great, great evening that kind of everyone really got into, and it worked fantastically well.
Thank you.
Much as I hate to say compliment you, but on this occasion I'm forced to do so.
And spoilers for anybody who didn't listen to the last episode, but it's based on John Carpenter's The Thing movie, and so I think we're right in saying that one of the players starts off as The Thing.
Pretty much. pretty much the...
Was that you, Tony?
That was me, yes. Which right. is apparently completely random, although I had a sneaking suspicion that it would be me.
Okay, I don't know why, because it was completely random. So the game sets up a couple of scenes at the start which recreate the opening scenes of the movie, at which point no one knows, no one's been allocated to be the thing at that point. And it's only at the advent of the first night after the Swedish pilots and the dogs that they were chasing are on the base that I then secretly rolled dice to decide who was the thing and then took everybody out of the room for 90 seconds exactly mm-hmm. to then tell them whether or not they were the thing. So it was totally random, Tony. It was there was no GM planning who did I want to be the thing behind it at all.
But it did mean, I guess, Tony, that you didn't get the chance to experience the fear and suspicion of your other players.
No, that's true.
So we need to get another one of your players in at some point to do another one of these interviews to find out how it went.
Although I could still see the fear and suspicion that was among the other players, although strangely for a lot of the game it wasn't as high as I expected, considering the group we were playing with is a group that together we often play kind of games of bluffing and suspicion games where they're the co-op games where there's a hidden traitor. So as a group we're kind of used to being suspicious
traitor.
Of each other, and that's a kind of standard feature of the games that we play all the time. So I was quite surprised that in this occasion actually the level of paranoia and suspicion, apart from a couple of the players, was lower than usual.
And I think the other thing to bear in mind is that the players who are playing the thing can also have fear and suspicion because they don't want to be found out. They know the others are hunting them.
Yeah.
So it might not be so much suspicion because you know who the other things are, but still there's the fear of being revealed and being identified.
Yeah, and actually you don't always know who the other things are because I assimilated Morgan first, and then in other scenes where I wasn't present, he then assimilated other players that I didn't know about, so I didn't necessarily know who all the things were other things had been created later on that I wasn't present for.
The way I played it was, or the way I planned to play it was that if you were a thing, you would know who all the other things were when you met them. There's always a difficulty in telling
without Morgan
telling
everybody else
the thing about the new things he's made. But
because obviously the scenes took place. When people went off to do things, the scenes took place out of the rewatch, so people didn't know what the other characters were up to. And then when you come back into the main room, everyone else, obviously it's difficult in that case then for the other things, Morgan in this case, to let me know who else had been assimilated.
Yeah. How did you find it as a player with that sort of rotation of being in the room or being out of the room, where when I was having to take people out to the kitchen to run their scene with everybody else being left behind? How did that play out
for
those who were left behind?
That worked absolutely fine, because obviously those left behind then kind of discuss what was going on and talk about their suspicions, and not knowing what the other characters were doing or what was happening with the other characters was part of the thing that increased the paranoia and suspicion. So I think in the context of the game, even though you weren't being directly involved in the scene that Jim was running that time, it still was a kind of key part of the game. It didn't feel like you were out of the game waiting for the game to carry on.
Good.
That's great. I was quite concerned as the thing that if the humans were well organised, they could have made it very difficult for me to assimilate anyone.
Yeah.
If they were really careful and only moved around in groups of three and never, had people going off on their own or in just groups of two, it could have been really difficult.
Yeah.
But actually the humans were incredibly sloppy at the start. And Morgan and I can't remember what we had to do, but we went off on our own, just the two of us, and everyone was happy for just the two of us to go.
You were doing something with the dogs, weren't you?
Possibly, because Morgan was the dog handler.
Yeah.
So I could immediately assimilate him, and that was one thing done. And at the same time, Connor, who was the mechanic or the pilot, had gone off to repair the helicopter on his own.
Yeah.
So our plan was to just wander around after I'd assimilated Morgan, which was to go around and then get Connor as well.
Yeah.
That was slightly scuppered because Paul, who was the commander of the base, then went out to talk to Connor about something, so he was there and slightly scuppered that.
I think it's as a GM, it felt, I could feel your struggles a little bit, and particularly when the players were going around in groups of three, which was fine. I mean, that showed that they were having a little bit of suspicion about and thinking about how to protect themselves. But the particularly when you assimilated both Connor and Paul, you know, you'd gone out to the radio shack to repair the radio. Your dice rolls had been so poor that I hadn't let you repair it, so I had to go and get some more kit. And Connor just went, "Oh, I'll go," and off he went on his own.
Yeah, so that's illustrates really how the dice mechanic, the rules that you use, the mutant year zero stroke Coriolis type rules, impacted the game. Mm. There's a couple of key points based on that, but also the sloppiness of the humans. So there, the three of us went together, all very sensible, sticking to a group of three, so we'll be safe and can't be caught off guard. The dice rolls, again, were so bad that we had multiple failures. We failed to repair the thing we were repairing in the radio shack, so we needed to go and get some other spare parts. And the sensible thing for the humans would be to say, okay, we'll stick together as three, we'll go and get the spare parts, we'll come back. But instead, Connor just went, oh, I'll go and get them, you wait here, I'll go off. So he went off, I was left on my own with Pete, so it immediately simulated him. Connor came back and simulated him. It was another two things. So a combination of the dice mechanic and the sloppiness of the humans.
Yeah.
Now I want to ask about the dice mechanic, because obviously I'd played this scenario 30 years ago. With Call of Cthulhu rules. Now I have also played Coriolis and run Coriolis, but I haven't played Mutant Year Zero, and you've played Mutant with Dave as well. So what did you think of the way that Dave mashed up the Coriolis and the Mutant versions of the Year Zero engine, well, as it's called nowadays, to create this game?
Well, the dice mechanics aren't that different anyway. The main difference in the dice mechanics between the two is the way the consequences of pushing a die roll is worked out. So in Mutant Year Zero, you have failures as well as successes on your roll. You have failures. If you push a dice roll, then those failures become activated, and that gives you negative consequences. Or consequences actually that aren't always negative. You can get additional mutations in Mutant Year Zero, or a piece of kit can break or whatever. So there's an immediate direct consequence to that, pushing that die roll and getting the failures. Whereas with Coriolis, the consequence of pushing a die roll is that you give darkness points to the GM. So the GM then has control really of what the consequences of pushing that.
It's kind of a future undefined consequence when you push,
which
in Coriolis, whereas in Mutant Year Zero,
which I think means you probably means you're less inclined to push dials in Mutant Year Zero, I think, because there's an immediate direct consequence.
Yeah, because in Mutant, if you get some negative failure rolls on the dice, they will then apply to the stat which is relevant to the activity you're taking, and that will come off your that stat. And if that stat reaches zero in Mutant Year Zero, you're broken, but you also take a critical hit. You don't get crits in the same way in Mutant as you do in Coriolis.
Mm-hmm.
The way that applied in the Thing game in Tango Tango 82 was Paul getting very frustrated at his bad rolls when he was trying to make Molotov cocktails, when he, Ed, and Morgan were together, and Morgan was the sole thing of the three of them. And he pushed the dice so hard that he broke himself. He fell in a heap on the floor. Morgan immediately assimilated Ed, and then they both immediately assimilated Paul. Mm. So the push mechanic led to...
Yeah, so it was another key moment, actually, where the dice mechanic determined...
gave the opportunity to the Thing to actually assimilate others.
Yeah, so in that case, actually, it didn't depend on the stupidity of the humans to work. It was just...
Although I guess you could say that Paul pushing that role
pushing
in the way
far.
That he did
was
a bit stupid, because it was running the risk of being broken. And he was familiar with Mutant, because he was one of the players in the Mutant campaign that we played last time round.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I do wonder whether he'd sort of forgotten that. And I think if I ran
it
again, I'd remind...
A little while since we'd played Mutant, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think if I ran it again, I would remind everybody at the start of the consequences of pushing die rolls and that kind of thing.
So those two moments really kind of sealed the fate of the humans, because that
There was only two that humans left.
The majority of the humans had been assimilated, and there was only two left, and they had no real chance then from that point on.
Although they did try, bless them.
Yeah, they had a go.
They did have a good go, but they both died.
So what came over from Coriolis? What bits of the Year Zero engine did you take from Coriolis and add to, if you like, the Mutant Year Zero?
The key thing I did from Coriolis was use the damage and stress, the hit points and the mind points.
Right.
So in Mutant, you take damage against all of the four stats.
Right.
So if any of those four stats, which is zero, you get broken. Whereas, obviously, in Coriolis, you put strength and agility to make your damage score.
Yeah.
And wits and empathy to make your stress score. And so I used that, because then that gave you a slightly bigger pool of hit points and mind points. And I wanted mind points to be quite important. I mean, one of the great things about playing Cthulhu rules for this was the whole sanity value, the sand score that you get. And then if you see things that are horrible, you would then roll against your sand to see how you reacted, whether you could cope with it or not. In this one, I wanted people to have to roll against their empathy and then take damage to their stress, mm-hmm. their mind points, if they saw a thing transforming or a human totally torn apart or something. So I wanted to try and recreate that. I'm not sure how much that came through, actually, in the game itself.
It did, because there was some early points in the game where we first see the dog that's been assimilated converting back into an alien as it tries to assimilate one of the other dogs that... I think pretty much all the characters see that, so everyone who saw that then had to do that role. So I think that did come across.
Yeah, good.
Fine. I think after that, until the final confrontation between the two remaining humans and all the things that had been created, probably didn't really apply because most of the stuff happened in secret, or the only person that saw the assimilation happening was the person being assimilated.
Yeah. But then it was too late anyway.
Then it was too late for them.
Yes. So I think that's the key thing I took from Coriolis to run this. I did use Coriolis fire rules in case we had that, because they are slightly different from the Mutant Year Zero rules, but nobody ever got burned to that point in the game.
And not enough flamethrowers, that's your problem. In Call of Cthulhu we had loads of flamethrowers.
We did. I did have a conscious think about... actually, is this something that in the movie as well is a bit odd? Why would an Antarctic research base have flamethrowers?
Like it wasn't a documentary.
So I'm not going to criticise John Carpenter for putting flamethrowers in his movie, because it's, as I said, one of my favourite movies of all time. But I thought, I'm not going to give you flamethrowers in this one, but if somebody wants to try and manufacture
one
with a gearhead, or, as you said in the last episode, Matthew, user... an aerosol spray with a lighter or something, then fine, let's go with it. But I'm not going to allow you to run around with sort of military grade flamethrowers.
Yeah,
flamethrowers slightly outside.
I guess aren't needed, but I do like this idea. You know, using the mind points thing from Coriolis, and I wonder whether if we do some more horror games at some point, there could be a. Neither of you guys have played Knight's Black Agent, which I'm very keen to run with you guys at some point.
Well, we did play at your birthday thing, didn't
we? Oh, we did, yes.
We played the
Stoker.
Yeah, that was excellent. That was really good.
But in there's a stability stat. And again, when you start seeing stuff, you roll against your stability stat and you can lose
points. See if you can cope with it.
See if you can cope with it. And I think that's quite an elegant way of doing it within the Year Zero engine, which we'll have to explore in future.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of the other rules, I largely just mashed up skills and talents just to suit my needs. For example, the ranged combat from Coriolis became Shoot, which is the same as the Mutant Year Zero version. I added the skill of Scavenger, which I mentioned in the last episode, which was trying to give the players an opportunity to do something innovative if I hadn't anticipated that they might want to do something, and they said, I need this particular bit of gizmo. I didn't want just to give it to them or not give it to them. I wanted to then say, right, well, see if you can find something that fits the bill. And I think that we didn't really use that again, I don't think, in the game. It didn't really come up. Because I'm not sure how... I think I was surprised about two things. One, as you mentioned earlier, Tone, how unsuspicious many of the human players were, with the exception of Rob in particular, and Dean as well. who were very, very paranoid and suspicious. They
and were the last two surviving humans.
Yeah, funnily enough.
Funnily enough.
And then this idea of people trying to come up with really innovative things to do around the camp to either protect yourselves or help try to find the alien. I mean, Dean had some really good ideas about how to identify the thing, but we didn't get, like in the game we had back in the day, Roger, who was playing the game, went and set up charges around the camp, linked them all together to his plunger, and sat in one of the shacks saying, anyone comes near me, well, you'll go. We didn't get any of that, but maybe that says more about Roger than the player.
Yeah, Roger, the avowed pacifist in real life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Indeed, yes. He obviously worked out his violent tendencies in role-playing.
Yes.
Which is probably a good place to work out your violent tendencies, isn't it?
That brings me on, actually, talking of these flavours. I don't know whether you've listened to our last episode, Tony. Obviously,
I have. Yes, of course. I have. Even though
obviously, he would say so in these circumstances.
Before we move off the thing, just one more. I find a compliment to you, Damon.
Oh, God.
Do
you have to compliment you?
I always actually get a compliment when you get that really pain, horrible, strained look on your face.
Since playing the scenario, I have rewatched the film, and I actually enjoyed the film more after having played it.
Oh, wow.
And it really made me feel actually the scenario did conjure up the feel of the film really well.
Well, it's funny, actually. I was thinking, you know, even though you were saying a lot of the players you felt were too trusting. Of course, that is what happens in the film. You know,
yes.
People do wander off in the dark on their own. Yes. And so I was thinking, as you were describing that, that doesn't feel wrong. Yeah, of course, there's one or two paranoid characters.
Yes, it only feels wrong because it's a group of players that are normally extremely untrusting of each other in the games that we play.
Yeah.
So just to remind everybody, Dave's notes or prep work from Tango Tango 82 are all available on his blog, which is Dave.
RPGGods.org. It's all there. Use it, please. Make the most of it. And give me feedback if there's things you think we could do differently, and I'd love to change it. But enjoy it is the main thing.
Brilliant. Now, last episode, you will have heard, Tony, that Dave and I were very excited about the Kickstarter that went live while we were recording.
As we were recording. Which you missed for 20 minutes after I spotted it.
Yeah,
and
but I
chose not to interrupt our flow, but
I was still supporter number 108 when
217.
Not a competition.
I'd have preferred to be supporter number 8. Actually, I think I would have been supporter number 9, but it took me so long to type while talking to you while we were having the thing that I was 108. But
I'm sure you'll get over it eventually, Matt.
Now, for me, I'm excited because this is yet another flavour of the Year Zero engine with yet another set of new mechanics and stuff that we can explore and use. Weirdly, I'm not that keen on, if you like, really trad retro fantasy with dwarves and elves and stuff, but I am excited by this game because of the whole having a big map to explore, which is something I think we did more regularly in our youth when we had time to prep big maps regular weekly sessions to explore them, and it's more difficult now. So I'm quite looking forward to it. We think we might have convinced Andy to kick in. He hasn't yet.
Yes, I was trying to convince him that he should kick in and then he should run it once he finishes the Pendragon campaign, which surely, I mean, must come to an end soon. I mean,
we've been playing Pendragon for 30-odd years, and I think Andy's thinking it is going to come to an end pretty soon.
At the end of November, possibly.
Possibly,
well,
yes.
There's been about four scenarios where I fully expected my character, the High King of all Great Britain, to die horribly, and I very nearly did in the last.
It's come very close.
It has
it's come
very
close,
isn't it? But I think that then probably sees a good ending of the campaign when I die and presumably Arthur takes over, unless I can kill him first.
I mean, Arthur, our loyal ally.
Well, he has been a pretty loyal ally most of the time. I do suspect his motives a little bit, but the fact that he stood aside to allow me to become king. It was a bit of a surprise at the time, but maybe Andy didn't want me and Arthur to have that fight at that point, because that would have ended the campaign one way or the other, I guess.
So,
but anyway, I'm hoping that Andy will want to run Forbidden Lands.
And I think he might. I think he might. I think he's quite keen to run a trad fantasy scenario, so that would be great.
Yeah, that would be great.
Have you kicked in, Tony?
I haven't kicked in. No, I've never kicked into a Kickstarter ever.
Well, it will be Andy's first time, yeah, if he can afford it. He's waiting for some money to come in from one of his jobs, so he might not be able to afford it. But I might.
Maybe we can lend him the money.
I've told him if he can't, we'll
cover it.
I'll cover it. Because it'd be great to get him to be running the system as well. And it'd be great for us to play, you and I, Dave, to play together, and you, Tony. But of course, we're always. But Dave and I, one of us is always on the other side of the screen.
Tony,
is what I'm saying.
I thought you just complimented you.
I know.
So have you read about it? Did Tony make you look at the Kickstarter even?
I haven't really looked at it in the detail. I'm aware of it, familiar with what the concept is, but not. I haven't really got into the finer detail of it.
I mean, it's very similar, as with all the other Year Zero Engine games. You know, the concept behind it is very similar.
Year Zero Engine TM.
TM for your Ligan, yes. Even though it was our idea.
They might debate that possibly, but yes, happy to claim it for the moment till we get told to wind our necks in. It's going to have a very, very similar feel. Again, you'd get your special talent for the race or your kin. You get a special talent for your occupation or your profession, and then you get to choose another one on top of that. I don't know very much about the arc concept that it might try and.
It's talking about this
stronghold
concept, which I think...
Which I like the idea of.
Which I really like the idea of, which is having done a dungeon delve or ready to keep or something, you might go, this would make a good base of operations. What do we need to turn it into our dungeon state?
So is that similar to the arc concept from Mutant Year Zero, having a base?
Yes.
And I quite like that idea. I mean, again, in Pendragon, that's the thing that one does. We became barons
of Lydney
first of all, and then and now
I'm the king.
You're the king, and I have prowess, don't I? But yeah, I think that idea of building that base is quite interesting.
And we talked about last time about the idea of having a arc concept in Coriolis, and didn't really come to any strong conclusions on what that might look like. But Tone, how do you feel as a Coriolis player? Would you welcome the idea of some kind of arc concept in the game, or would that be sort of one thing, you know, too much for the campaign we've got running now?
Well, I think the campaign we've got running now, we're on our way to a particular system to find a particular individual, Jubal's brother, and that. It's taking us quite a long time.
Yeah.
So we're not in the campaign running now is not one where we're going back to our base operations or back to Coriolis or any other kind of permanent base.
So at the
end of every
scenario.
So it's not like Mutant where it's really based around the Ark, and actually going away from your Ark is a really dangerous, risky thing because the land is contaminated and it's really about surviving in your Ark. Coriolis has quite a different feel. It's more open and exploratory of the whole Third Horizon. So I think I'm not averse to the idea of having a base to go back to, and realistically you would probably have something like that. But the campaign running now is we're out exploring. We spent 4 or 5 scenarios in Xalos and we've only just managed to get out of there in the kind of last but one scenario, so we're not going back to
a base.
The base. Our base is the ship.
It's an interesting distinction, actually, isn't it? So, in Mutant Year Zero, you are going back to that. That is your base of operations, and actually, your scope to stray far from that is really limited.
Yes,
because the further you go, the more likely you are to die.
Yeah, you're never going too far away from your arc because it's too dangerous.
And in the campaign that we did run, when you did go too far from your arc,
you went horribly wrong.
You didn't all die, but you all got assimilated by a bunch of robots.
Yes. You almost got away with it.
And that ended the campaign there and then. Which was quite good timing because Coriolis was coming along as well. So I guess that's a really good insight because I hadn't really thought about it like that. And it would then, on the basis of our discussion last time, Matt, that would then bring us back to the ship being the being the base rather than a haven or a planet or a space station somewhere. Unless, of course, you then accepted that it might be 8 or 10 scenarios, potentially, if you're going on a bit of an odyssey, before you could then influence what happens in the base again.
Since the days of Traveller, I guess a lot of science fiction has been very much space murder hobos, hasn't it, in terms of role-playing. Very much, let's cause as much havoc as we can on this planet, let's steal whatever it is we want, and rather than face the consequences, let's just go to a different planet.
Well, and that is what's been happening in the campaign that I'm running with Tony, where they're not going to want to go back to Zalos anytime soon.
We're certainly not.
And have already chosen that when they've reached Oticon and completed their task, they're going to go back the other way.
Yeah, whatever the pirates around there think.
Precisely. Yes. So there is a little bit of that, although not anywhere near as much as you would in Traveller.
It wasn't really by design. We didn't want any trouble, Governor. We wanted to get in and get out.
But I think that's probably what most Traveller players would say as well, though, isn't it? Even as they're nuking from orbit just to be sure and then jumping out of the system.
But that doesn't need to be the way the campaign goes. And I think, you know, there could still be... I mean, I think it makes me realise possibly why they thought, at Freelagan they might well have gone, oh, let's scrap the Haven rule. Let's scrap the Ark rules because that's not relevant to science fiction space games. And they were probably right.
Yes.
Most of the campaigns aren't going to use them.
Might be some you could, though.
You could, yeah.
Well, Mutant Year Zero, it really is based around the Ark. And the kind of between scenario bits where you're developing the Ark and you're choosing the projects you're going to do, a lot of the game is about developing and maintaining your home. Whereas in Coriolis, again, there's a lot more scope for going further afield, and with the jumps, the cost of doing portal jumps means you're probably not going to go too far in one scenario. So you are inevitably going to, if you have a permanent base, you're going to be away from it for much longer periods in Coriolis than
Year
Zero, so the focus on it inevitably would be less.
But I think, I'm just aware of let us remember the byline for Coriolis, which is Firefly meets Arabian Nights, and the last Firefly or Serenity campaign that you ran, Dave, we were in a base. We had our haven, for want of a better word, that was developing, and we could well have run that in a way that was about us build. Well, we did defend the community against all sorts of interlopers, and we were building a system of law and stuff like that in there, in a way, and that could have been running this sort of system. So it's not impossible to run campaigns.
No.
I guess the beauty of the recently announced Open Gaming License is that if people want to run those campaigns and test out that sort of system, they can, and then they can publish it for the other
parts of the community.
Community that want to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the Open Gaming License is a really good idea, and
I wonder who thought of that idea. We could go back and check on the internet.
To our listeners, I don't know whether Free League were already considering something like this, but right now in the hammam, the door isn't very wide, and Matt's head is about 10 foot wider than the door because he did suggest it on the forums, and that was backed by another forum member, and then immediately after, it was a stretch goal, and then immediately after that, it was a successfully completed stretch goal, which is brilliant. And so, well done. Thank you, Matt, for your idea.
And that means that, at some point, there could be a professional version of Tango Tango 82 out there, ready for people to download, full of lovely illustrations and stuff like that.
Well, I'm working on it as we speak.
Excellent.
Well, I'm not, but I will. Well, I don't know if anybody's even downloaded it yet to even play it, let alone buy the damn thing. But
but here in the hammam, there is a glow of self satisfaction and smugness. I have to admit,
isn't there always?
I notice, guys, that we are 33 minutes into this recording,
and we've got more business to conduct in the hammam this afternoon. A game of Simba Room. The first time I'm going to run that, so that'll be really interesting.
Yeah, now, so, Simba Room, I'm just wondering whether we need to expand the Coriolis effect to cover maybe all of Year Zero engine games, and maybe there's something about all of Swedish games, or Swedish games translated into English. I'm not going to learn Swedish just to play Swedish games.
I'll get my wife to translate to it. I think so, and I wonder whether we can have suddenly spin-offs for now. You know, the Simba Room effect, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
And
what, you mean occasional specials?
Yeah, something like that. And whatever else we might think that would be people might be interested to listen to.
Anyway, any feedback on that idea, do drop us a line on all the usual routes, which we'll tell you about in some other part of this episode.
A bit later on in the programme. But for now, thanks very much again, Tone, for coming along to Players in Hammam.
Pleasure as always.
It's been a delight having you here. And thanks, Matthew.
So it was great to have Tony back in Hammam. It was really pleased that he was willing to come back in again. He was really delighted to do so. And I think we should invite him in again sometime in the not-too-distant future for some more discussions with the players. But moving on.
Yeah, and maybe some other players.
Absolutely. Yeah, not just Tony. Yeah, indeed. I think...
from your campaign or get Andy in at some point. Talking of which, actually, Andy sent me an email with an idea that I have expanded upon for Talent of the Episode. The natives of Namada are a proud but primitive race, which Foundation anthropologists believe are ancient humanites. Fierce warriors, perhaps bred for some long-forgotten war, they organise in tribes and compete in an arcane system of intertribal sports and challenges. Foundation scientists have identified a unique response to trauma in the Namadan physiology, which has become known as the Namadan talent. My long-standing gaming friend Andy, who plays Salem, the humanite with a hardened epidermis in my Coriolis campaign, sent me an idea for a new humanite talent. What he actually said, in a text, was, "Just another quick thing, old bean, I have thought of a talent for humanites. When injured, the humanite gets a bonus blast of strength or speed due to the nerve impulse boost, just like good old martial law." Now, given our international audience, I should clarify that we're not talking about government by the military or martial law, the character from Tekken. Instead, we're talking about the ultra-violent San Francisco cop charged with hunting down rogue superheroes, created by Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill and first published by Marvel's Epic Comics imprint. Anyhow, he can't feel pain, though, to be honest, I can't recall if getting hurt actually increases his strength. It's a great idea, and given that the Forbidden Plans Kickstarter had just started, and that surely that game would include some sort of berserker talent, I wanted to explore how it might turn out in Coriolis. So the first thing I asked Andy was whether he thought the increase would take effect with HP damage, or only after a critical hit. He said, "I think it has to be crits, or otherwise it would be too powerful. In some ways, it's a kind of berserker talent, I suppose." Great minds think alike. Although, I spent some time looking at the critical hit route. It's attractive, especially down at the lower end of the table. Your berserker gets their nose bloodied, is knocked back for a round or two, but then comes back harder and or faster. That works for crits up to about 42 on the table on page 96. But higher than that, and you're into injuries with the potential to immobilise. Yes, the talent could have special rules for how critical injuries are dealt with, but then that starts getting messy. So what about hit points? How many hit points do you have to take before the talent is triggered? When it is triggered, do the increased strength or agility increase the number of hit points that you can take? I toyed with ratios. Every 2 hit points taken being worth 1 point, you could add to your strength, agility, or, I thought, maybe to your initiative. If it was 2 for 1, I thought, and strength and agility max out at 5 each, then you don't get into a loop of damage that you take, enabling you to take more damage. Such a loop could work, I thought, but only if there are consequences after the fight. But I was still nagged by the feeling that there is just a little too much paperwork involved in keeping track of hit points, strength and agility, and current initiative. And the effect was too linear. Cinematically, all the best berserkers look beaten. Then they lift their head with fire in their eyes and you think, uh-oh, now I've made him angry. And that made me think there was a simpler solution. They look beaten. The talent comes into effect when they're broken. Now, my first thought was to use hit points twice. The first time the PC hits 0 hit points, they don't actually become broken, but rather get a second wind, returning to full hit points and adding 1 to strength or agility and initiative. The effect remains until the fight is over, or until they hit 0 hit points a second time. But again, there's an accounting problem. How should a player use their HP track twice? Putting 1 check on each box the first time, and then turning that into a cross the second time? Maybe. But I had a better idea. The Berserker Rage should be a mental effect. So, let me present the Namadan Talent. A character with this talent can elect to assign physical damage to mind points instead. Any stress damage is also taken from mind points as usual. At 0 mind points, instead of a breakdown, the character rages. The character can still take any actions that involve dice, but for the duration of the rage, increase both strength and agility to 5 and deduct the number of points required to do so from empathy first and then wits. Neither can drop below 1. The character's current initiative increases by 1 also. From this point on, damage is deducted from hit points as usual. The rage lasts for 6 hours or until the character is broken, knocked unconscious by a critical injury, or treated with command or medikurgy as for breakdown. As for breakdown, upon recovery, roll 1 die, and if the result is 1, reduce mind points permanently by 1 point. So, I didn't send Andy that whole article, but I did send him the talent, and he sent back an email really quickly saying, and it has surprised me because I didn't think he actually wanted it for himself, but he really wants this talent.
Well, frankly, I'm not bloody surprised because, I mean, this is excellent. I love what you've done here, Matt, but I have, to use your words, I have a few concerns that I want to raise. there's a couple of things here, but I'll move directly to the talent before. I think there's a couple of other things in your build-up background, which, again, I love the way you do all that, that suggest some other ideas. I'll mention those, but let's first go to the Namadan talent itself.
Okay.
This feels...
What is wrong with my Namadan talent?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think it's just enormously overpowered, it feels to me. And I'll explain why. So you start out by saying that a player can elect to assign physical damage to mind points instead of hit points. That's fine. Isn't that just kind of doubling your hit points? So all you do in a combat is siphon off damage off from your hit points to your mind points until you get down to 1. And then you take it on your hit points. So what you're in effect doing is giving your character with this talent an immediate bonus of hit points equal to their mind points minus 1. Which seems really, really, really powerful. But that's just the...
Yeah, out of me starting to actually do it by saying, well, let's go through the hit points twice.
Yes.
You know, 1 before you berserk, and then when you're in the rage, you get them again. And then I thought, the reason why I thought transferring it to mind points was twofold. One is that if anybody's doing anything towards building a character who's a good soldier, they have probably prioritized their physical stats over their mental stats. So one of the reasons I went for mind points is I thought their mind point track wouldn't be quite as long as their hit point track. So effectively it wasn't going to double in the way that just using hit points twice would have done.
Yeah,
and the other thing...
I get that, yeah.
Which I'll just say before you carry on. The other thing, of course, is that there is... whereas the hit point track, you just recover your hit points when you're treated in the end. The mind point track, when that goes down to 0, that does have... or can have a chance of permanent damage or permanent trauma. So... that's why I went for that.
Yeah, I saw that. But I think there's kind of It feels to me there's two talents in one here. Because I think the rage talent, the rage aspect of the talent, is probably worthy of a talent in itself, over and above the allowing to assign physical damage to mind points part of the talent, which again is probably worthy of a talent in itself. I think it's that powerful. So it feels to me that you've got probably two really good talents, but you've put them together, which perhaps makes it a bit more powerful than perhaps it ought to be. I had a little look in both Coriolis and Mutant Year Zero. There are talents that do something around getting broken and then getting back up again.
Before you go on there, the other thing I wanted to say is I wanted to get this out quickly before we saw what I'm convinced there's going to be a Berserker talent in Forbidden Lands. And I just wanted to think, well, what would a Berserker be in my head before we see what the guys from Free Legan think in Forbidden Lands. No. But admittedly, I haven't even, of course, looked at or didn't think that there would be one in Mutant Year Zero. So tell me about that one.
It's not so much a Berserker talent, but it's a getting more hit points after you get broken talent. And it's called Never Surrender. And it gives you a roll on your strength when you're broken. And each success restores 1 point of strength immediately. So you go down, but you get up again straight away. That's a once per use, talent per scenario.
Once per session.
Once per session. Yeah.
You stumbled over the words a bit.
I'm desperately trying to take the edge off what I'm saying now because you sound like I'm upsetting you, and I don't want that.
No, it's okay. I'm not stressed. When I've taken enough points of stress, you'll know about it.
Oh, you've got this talent, have you? Okay. there is that suggestion. Also, in Coriolis, the Lady of Tears talent is also similar, whereby you restore 1 point when you're broken by stress or damage. That's a one use per game or per session, and it costs a darkness point. So it just feels that being able to... I mean, let's say, you know, even your best combat character is going to have at least 4, if not 5, on their mind point track, which is going to give them at least 3, if not 4, extra hit points if they're allowed to assign physical damage to mind points kind of willy-nilly. So I think you may well be onto something then. I really like it. There might be something else in there about how often you could do it, or if it costs a darkness point each time you do it, perhaps.
But also, I must admit, now, I went for this. So I had been thinking about once per session, definitely. Mm. And I must admit, I entirely forgot about darkness points. I think I was going to add a darkness point. You had to have a dark point to trigger it.
Can you forget about darkness points next time you play? That'll be good.
I'll try my best. But yeah, I think you're right. I was going to add a darkness point in to trigger it, or just mention that it cost a darkness point to trigger, because by God, it's dark. But I think I got one of the reasons why I forgot is I then got very excited by, I was going to say, the rage lasts until the end of the combat. And then I thought, no, actually, you don't want the rage lasting until the end of the combat, because this guy, because of this thing where I said that, you know, you get this amazing strength and agility, but at the cost of your empathy and wits, or empathy first, and then your wits. I quite like the idea of then you've got to deal with 6 hours of game time, not necessarily play time, but six hours of game time where you can't do anything social.
I noticed that.
So I think in a way that was my, for that reason, I didn't think you'd want to do it more than once per session. But I think you're right. You could easily say this is a once per session thing because, frankly, you know, if it happened twice in a session, it would screw up everybody else's fun. I'm happy to add that limit in. No problem at all.
I think I picked out the rage lasts for 6 hours, and I'm really glad you mentioned that because I was going to ask you about it. Because certainly on the face of it, that looks kind of too long, but the way you've explained it makes a lot of sense. I wonder if that the effects of the rage on your empathy and your wits lasts for 6 hours, but the actual rage doesn't. So maybe at the end of the rage, all your stats go back to normal, your strength and your agility return to normal, but actually you're effectively mentally and empathetically damaged by it. So you end up with your mind point staying low, and those stats staying low for 6 hours. Because otherwise, it felt very much like you've kind of got the Incredible Hulk running around for 6 hours, pounding doors in and people's heads in. Whereas, funny enough,
Hulk was a character that I had in my head when I was thinking, in fact, about the thing in Age of Ultron where Black Widow has become the person that talks the Hulk down.
Yes,
when it's time to talk the Hulk down. And, the other thing is when I hit upon this and I read the rules from Breakdown and stuff like that, and I was thinking, well, I want to use as many of those standard rules for Breakdown as I can in this. So the idea is that untreated, the race lasts for 6 hours, but somebody with Command or Medicurgy could treat the mind points and then calm the person down.
Yes. I think it feels to me that the effect that you're going for, or the best effect you're going for there, is for the 6 hours after that happens, you are totally susceptible to being broken by mind points. And if you are kind of in your rage, so actually you don't need to worry about mind points, because if somebody pisses you off, you just punch them again. I wonder whether there is a dynamic there, actually, because you should be weaker after the rage has happened. You've taken the benefit of the rage in the combat. You've won the combat. Yeah. But actually after that, you get your, you've had your high, now you've got your low. Yeah. So I wonder whether it works kind of better that way. But I really like
it. I'll tell you what, I think we can probably playtest this, because
Andy wants it.
Well, there's another question to ask here. So when Andy came back saying, oh, yeah, I'll have that one, I'll have that Namadan DNA, and I was going, but no, Andy, you're humanite. Well, I haven't actually said this to him yet, but in my head,
yes.
I was going, but you've already got a humanite talent. I don't think you can have more than one humanite talent. However, in this case, I had been thinking, I was writing this and, we had three established characters, so I wasn't imagining anybody was going to be rolling a new one soon unless I rolled another 66 behind the screen.
Yeah, you're not going to let me off it twice now, are you?
I wasn't thinking this would come up in play as a player character. So I was immediately thinking, how am I going to use this as a GM? And I thought it would be great fun if you met some guys, knocked them down in combat, and then they got up again like this. And how would you deal with that? A little bit like Firefly's Reavers, if you like. So I was seeing it very much as non-player character type thing. But now Andy suggested it, I must admit there's a wicked side of me that wants to say, yeah, Andy, maybe this is something that develops out of the DNA that has been created, and then we can actually playtest this and see exactly where it breaks the system.
Yeah, I mean, the other way you could do it potentially is have it as some form of biosculpt.
Now that's a good idea.
So rather than gene splicing, it's then it can come with a particularly high cost, because biosculpts are very expensive.
Yeah, and that would be another cost that deflates its superpowerness a bit.
Yes.
Some sort of neural sheathing. I'm liking that.
Yeah. Ooh. So that might work quite well.
Ooh. Ooh, I do like that.
So, I think the last comment I would make on this, that if you're going to leave it as it is, I'm really glad that you're giving it to Andy, because he's on my side. That would be great. Yeah.
Maybe it will. They'll be the bad guys as well as Andy.
Possibly, but then Andy can deal with them, because he'll be really tough then. No, I like it. I love these things where it spawns loads of different comment and debate and discussion around them. And it's good. I mean, the one other thing,
and with this, of course, with all this stuff that we're talking about here, we're not saying this is the right way of doing it.
No,
so
of course.
Really keen if people go, no, you don't realise you made that terrible mistake.
Yeah,
do tell us.
No, the other thing I was going to briefly mention, having read your background running into that, where you talk about the impact of a crit and whether it would stop that, I was just wondering whether you could delay the effect of a crit by.
I did wonder about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could maybe make a strength roll plus one success, or a strength roll and the number of successes are the number of turns that the the critical damage is delayed with a minimum of one, say. Because that then might give you that heroic last moment. If you've had a headshot that's going to kill you, you know, you manage to do two more turns of stuff and save everybody else before you die.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the really interesting thing, is I was thinking along those lines, but then I did think, and I think with the experience of the headshot, that then that's where it breaks. I feel it kind of breaks down the narrative, that, you know, whereas could well have, you know, an internal injury that is going to kill you, but you power through it because of a talent. But then if, you know, a headshot's a headshot. And then I started thinking, if you have different rules for different crits, then that gets messy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thinking that pulled me away from it being on a crit. But, you know, maybe we should give that a go as well. See how that works.
Cool. Good stuff, Matt. Excellent.
Brilliant. Okay, now, you've played, I believe, another game of Spectral Corsair, haven't you?
We did, yeah. We had a game last week before. I thought I'd just give a very brief update on this one about what happened. But I think there's a couple of things in it that I'd want to pull out, which are... one's a kind of rules thing, which I just thought worth mentioning. And the other is about player behaviour. And I don't mean like, you know, sitting in the corner being grumpy or being disruptive, but you know, so this is
you were being GM, so you wouldn't have had any players doing that.
You told me earlier
it's
that
me
I was
that, the, but that with that sort of player behavior.
You told me I was the best player earlier. Is that because
I did, yeah. But that was a lie, David. You know it was a lie.
Yes, I know that whenever either of us say that the other person is the best about something, it's a lie, isn't it, Matthew?
I guess that may be the case.
You walked into that one, mate. Anyway, right, so...
anyway, tell me about the Spectral Corsair.
Spectral Corsair, Episode 7, No Rest for the Wicked. Right, they got themselves to Mira, finally. And for them, that meant they had a chance to rest, recuperate, and take life a little bit easy for a while to get over the trials and tribulations of Zalos. But nothing goes easy for these guys, so... Their destination in Mira was a planet, Trigon, which is orbiting Ant-Mira. So they had to make a portal jump. And, well, nothing goes right for them, and they happened to fail the portal jump roll. So they had a misjump. Now, this is my first ever misjump as a referee. I think, as a player as well. And it was... It's led me to a point around kind of the rules. Actually, how bad is it if you... fail a portal jump? So they rolled on the table on, I can't remember the page number in the book now, but they rolled quite low. They rolled 16 or something, which basically meant that their ship was out of commission for 1d6 days. They rolled the dice, they rolled a 1, so they had 1 day delay to their journey before they could then think about making the portal jump again. What I did do was make the engineer roll a bunch of technology rolls to repair the ship and used up a load of their spare parts. So they ended up using about 1,000 burrs worth of spare parts to do it. Because otherwise it was all just
Did they have to pay for a second portal jump as well?
Well, I was being really kind to them. So I was saying that in Mira, internal portal to portal jumps for free. So, whereas jumping out of the system wouldn't be free, but jumping in the system was free because otherwise it just ends up in my version of Mira, it ends up putting a tax on internal trade and economy, and they didn't want to do that. But the portal jump, the failed portal jump table is on page 140 of the main book. And actually, most of the outcomes for failing a portal jump are just inconvenient. They might damage the ship a little bit. It's only when you get right to the high end where it becomes really inconvenient. So... you've got to roll 54 or more for the ship to come back with a spirit haunting it or something, which is interesting. That's fine. 62 or above, and the ship disappears in the portal for 1d6 months and then comes out. And that's kind of getting into the realms that I quite like, because it really changes the price of fish of your particular scenario. If you want to rush to get somewhere, suddenly being in portal space for 3 months before you reappear... could be a real problem. But then there's the other one that has a similar effect, which is 71 to 76. And you can only roll that, obviously, if you jump blind. Because when you jump blind, which means making no calculations at all, and you misjump, you then add one to your tens dice. So it gives you a chance of doing this. Otherwise, if you don't jump blind, this can't happen to you. So this one is when the ship enters the portal, but it exits in a random system or through a random portal. So I kind of think that, certainly in my campaign, it would be quite fun to have a kind of Star Trek Voyager moment where they fail the roll and they end up 10 systems away and they've got to now, you know, fight their way back again. And for me, as the GM in that situation, yes, it would create an enormous problem straight away. But the rules are so well designed that it's very easy to very quickly randomly roll up a local system, a mission, a bad guy or a good guy for them to meet. It would be really easy for me to just finish the rest of that scenario on that day and then plan for what they want to do next to get back. So it kind of feels to me that jump, failed jump outcome table is a bit boring, and it could be a lot more interesting with some of the potential outcomes.
That's interesting. I wonder though whether was there any palpable sense of relief when they found that it had only cost them, you know, some spare parts and a day's delay?
There was.
Were they aware of how wrong it could have been?
I think because none of them actually run the game, and I don't suppose any of them have ever looked at what the potential outcomes are on the table. When Tony failed his handful of dice twice, and he had a lot of dice for the jump, the look on their faces was, oh my God, this is a disaster. But actually, the chances are it isn't a disaster. It's just a bit of a pain in the backside, and you're delayed by a few days, potentially. So I think there is a difference between the real likely outcome, how severe it would be, and the player perception of how bad the outcome is likely to be. Certainly in my group, anyway. I haven't disabused them of that until, of course, they listen to this podcast. But I might change the table before then, because I just think there's probably more we can do with it, and maybe a bigger risk of something a bit more severe going wrong. Don't know. I'll be interested in your and the listeners' views on whether I'm onto something there. But anyway, that came up.
Yeah, you see, I don't think I'm qualified to comment because it just hasn't happened.
No.
So I'm kind of nervous about changing the table, but at the same time, it has happened, and you know that could have been a lot of fun. And if it only happens, you know, if the odds are that it very rarely happens, then given that all the failures they have to make before there's a portal jump mishap, then maybe there's just not a fun in the game unless you're playing on a weekly basis and managing to do a lot of portal jumps in that time.
Yeah, and I think obviously if you're misjumping, I mean if you're jumping blind, which means you're probably being chased by someone or it's an emergency, then you lose 3 dice. But Tony is the pilot of our ship, has got a lot of dice. He's got the chapel on board. They will always pray in advance, so that gives them 2 extra dice straight away. He'll pray to the right icon, so he gets an extra dice on the reroll. So they do all their preparation in exactly the way you would expect a sensible, cautious pilot to do it. So he's actually going to fail pretty rarely, because in that sense, he probably rolled about, I'm not sure how many dice exactly, but he's probably rolling 12 or 13 dice each time. So he's probably rolling 25 or 26 dice. And not to get 1-6 out of that lot is going to be pretty unlikely. Unless you're Tony, because he seems to do that quite a lot. but for normal people, that might be, you know, the chances of them having a really bad misjump might be so vanishingly small that you might as well almost not bother. Don't know.
Yeah, it's making me think a little bit about, you know, how games are designed to tell a particular story.
Yeah.
And, you know, probabilities are such that maybe if you don't play enough, you don't get the story that the game is designed to tell. So maybe, you know, when we're playing as relatively rarely as that group does, you're getting together once a month, it's not always Coriolis. Am I right?
Well, we tend to play about once every 3 weeks on average, Coriolis.
Yeah.
If we can
and,
manage
you know,
it.
And, yeah. and our group, we only get together to actually play Coriolis Well, surprisingly, we've done it more often than we should have done this year.
We have, yeah.
But, you know, it might only be once every 6 months. So maybe there is an argument for sometimes tweaking the tables to make Coriolis do more Coriolis-type stuff in-game.
I guess on the other hand, though, if you made it if you made the chances too great that being fired around somewhere totally random in the third horizon would happen too often, then that would get a bit tiresome after a while.
Yeah.
You're just about, they're making their last jump to Oticon to find the guy they're looking for. They spent 15 scenarios getting there, and then, boom, they end up in Dabaran.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there have been problems on their mission already, haven't there? So maybe actually the table was being
kind,
just as fair as it should have been in only delaying them for an extra day.
Yes, I think there is definitely a ill-fated kind of feel to their mission, even though no one's died yet. But
time for another Firefly quote: things don't go smooth.
No, exactly. Right, let me just tell you what happened on this particular game. So they got themselves back to Carfi, which is the moon of Trigon, where Samar's hammam and her insula, her apartment block, was. And that's where they were staying. And when they arrived, they were greeted like old friends, and Samar gave them full use of one of her apartments and handed over 20,000 burr that Jubal had sent them to help them on their way. 8-Bit was a bit suspicious about that, and he made a joke about it, but Samar obviously looked a bit uncomfortable. So when they found out a little while later that she'd actually held on to 25,000 burr that Jubal had sent, they were obviously a bit disappointed and upset. Prior to that, they'd had a healer, a shaman, come around to take a look at Carter's leg, and his leg was lignifying. It was turning into wood as a result of the wound he received on board the Throne of Shahada when he was rescuing Alina from the Trial of the Icons. Mm. And this guy, called Orbari, looked very shocked and very, very horrified at what was happening and advised that Carter should have his leg amputated at the earliest opportunity to save his life. So they obviously needed all this money. But it turned out Samar broke down when they challenged her over this money. And it turned out that she's in enormous debt. She owes some gambling debts to a local gang, a local branch of the Miran gang called the Okradama, and she'd also owed them protection money that she hadn't been able to pay. And to enforce this, they'd taken her niece as surety for Samar to pay the debts. And she'd given them 25,000 burr, which was the player's money, in the hope that that would get her niece released. It wasn't the full amount, but that didn't happen. So she was in a real state. So this gangster called Irania had their money, had Samar's niece, and the players had a very long debate over what they should do about it. Ultimately, Osgar and Hanbal, who were the two humanites of the group, decided to go and recce the shrine, the location where Irania had her base of operations. And they got a sense of its defences. It was quite well defended. And they realised that a frontal assault on the shrine to try and rescue the girl was going to be, at the very least, costly and very dangerous. And this begins to play into the other thing I just wanted to pull out about player behaviour. So I'm now seeing in my group, the players being really, really reticent to get involved in a gunfight because of how dangerous it is. And they
You know what happens in a gunfight, Dave?
People get hurt, don't they?
Yeah.
So they were really, really reluctant to try and assault this base. So they tried to find another way of managing this. And they found out that Orbari, this healer, was a member of a temple called the Temple of the Weeping Mother, which was closely connected to this shrine where Irania was working. So they spoke to him and tried to convince him that Irania was a criminal. Now, unfortunately, this didn't go down very well. They screwed up their manipulation roles. Orbari immediately resented their accusation that Irania was a criminal. He resented the implication that he consorted with criminals, and he thought that their offer of one of the Icon-blessed cats, one of the kittens that they've still got on board the ship, of which they've got six left, he thought their offer of that as a gift to him was not only a complete con, it was blasphemous. So he got really angry. Now, Ubar is a first come, and Hanbal hates first come. And so with the judicious use of a darkness point, I activated Tony's problem. And Tony got very angry and started shouting at this guy with Osgar, who also has a problem where he hates people who are too preachy because of his background, having come from Zalos B in the war. So Tony, Hanbal and Ulbari were having a sanging match, which ended up being a fight. So Tony punched him. Punched a priest, you know, in their car park or in their front porch, in front of, you know, members of the public. Not a really clever idea. Dean tried to stop this happening, but was getting more and more wound up by Ulbari's pronouncements. So when Hanbal managed to control himself, Osgar lost it and punched him in the side of the head and knocked him out. So anyway, they had this unconscious priest on their hands. A little while later, and some smelling salts later, a very wary Ulbari came round in their apartment in Samar's Insula. And whilst he was, at the very least metaphorically, if not literally, a captive audience, Valdez tried again to explain the problem and made some brilliant manipulation roles. So they were able to get him on their side to try and broker a deal. And in the end, he managed to broker the deal for them. They got their money back. They got the daughter, the niece, released. And an undertaking that the gang wouldn't cause any more trouble for Samar and her hammam. And with all that, they were able to get their cybernetic legs replaced. They were able to get some peace and quiet and a couple of weeks rest at the hammam before they now travel on to the Zib system, which is the next system in their travel. But I was really pleased that their die rolls went well, so they were able to resolve the issue without having to actually end up fighting people and using, you know, lots of violence. Even though there was a bit of fisticuffs going on, they were never going to kill him in doing that. They weren't trying to kill him. The other upshot was that they agreed to hand over all of the kittens. So when they managed to get Ulbari up to the ship to prove to him that they weren't lying about these kittens, the manipulation role that they made was so good that I had Ulbari kind of fall to his knees in religious awe and dumbstruck, and he was convinced from that point on. And but he then took the kittens for his temple. So it worked really well, and it pulled out a couple of really interesting things for me around the portal jumping and the mist jumping, and the player behaviour. I think it's going to be interesting when they do start pulling their guns out again, to see under what circumstances they feel that's necessary, considering how bad the consequences can be.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, I think it's a good thing.
Yes.
Generally,
yeah, me too.
People don't use violence.
Yeah.
You know, and interestingly, I've been reading for an upcoming game with my weekly group, Unknown Armies, and the combat section of Unknown Armies starts off with a section on ways to get out of fighting.
Yeah. I think the big mistake that we made in the game where Yaphet wasn't killed was, one, we were all thirsting to fire our guns a bit, because we hadn't fired our guns in the whole game. I hadn't even thrown a punch in the whole game. Which, as a player, was a bit understandable, but a bit foolish, I guess. But there would have been potentially other ways of resolving that bounty hunter license, rather than just running through the door and opening fire. We should have at least given the guy a chance to come quietly, which we didn't. And
no,
if it hadn't been for the dance, if it hadn't been for the dancer's talent, I would have paid for it very dearly. So a good lesson, a good lesson for Yaphet in, you know, let's talk first rather than just get shot.
Let's see if we can. Now I noticed we're running short of time.
Yep.
We've done an hour.
We have. So this is longer than we thought it was going to be. But again, we don't shut up. We're a bit too loquacious, aren't we?
But I think I've got to start cooking tea quite soon.
So, in order to make sure that you don't upset Mrs. Tyler Jones, we've got a few things coming up next, just to mention before we sign off, haven't we, Matthew?
Yes. So, first of all, of course, in December, Dragon Meet on the 2nd of December in London is taking place. and the Coriolis Effect is part of the podcast zone, so we will be there. We've also, both of us, signed up to run games of Coriolis that people can sign up to play. I'm not convinced, actually, that we're going to have enough time to do all of that, so we might need to review how we spend all our time, but we're definitely going to be at Dragon Meet. If you're in London on the 2nd of December, come and see us.
Come and say hello. It'd be brilliant to meet everybody, or as many who can make it. That would be great. The other bit of news we have... Really exciting bit of news coming up, that falls under the heading of coming next. For the next podcast, which will probably be early November now, because both Matthew and I have got some holidays to take. But we will have, by then, had the great honour and opportunity to interview Nils Karlin and Costa Kostulas of Free League over in Stockholm, and we will be replaying some of that on the podcast next time round. Can't say how much we're looking forward to it. We're really delighted that they're able to see us, and we are really looking forward to chatting to them and having a couple of beers. Just can't wait. That's going to be fabulous.
It's very exciting. Really exciting news. So, I think... On that bombshell, as they used to say on Top Gear, let's say our goodbyes and see everybody. Well, I guess there is a chance we might drop an episode of Simba Room while we're gone, but otherwise we'll see you all in November. So it's goodbye from David, and it's goodbye from me.
And may the icons bless your adventures.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by Font Fabric.